Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University, co-sponsored by the Goethe Institute Boston, the Goethe Institute Washington, D.C., and Brandeis University Center for German and European Studies. Our speaker is Harald Welzer, professor for transformation design at the University of Flensburg. Professor Welzer's lecture is titled Climate Wars, What People Will Be Killed For in the 21st Century. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Henrik Selin, Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University.
Our speaker today is Harald Welzer, who has a long, long resume. Among other things, he is the head of the Center for Interdisciplinary Memory Research at the University of Essen, but perhaps more important for what he's going to talk about today, he's also the professor for transformation design at University of Flensburg and the executive director of a foundation called Futur 2, which looks at sort of future societies and think about the future. He is an extremely prolific writer, who has published a large number of books that have been translated into a number of different languages. I think the last number I saw was 12 or 15 or something like that. And the main reason he's here, which particular book, is this one with a rather provocative title, Climate Wars, and perhaps an even more provocative subtitle, Why People Will Be Killed in the 21st Century. Harald told me before that he will start his presentation today with this book as the jumping-off point. It was published in Germany in 2008 and was published in English in 2012, by Polity Press.
Thank you very much for inviting me here and for this introduction. The most important point is that for me, this book is now 6 years old and had a big influence on what I do now, because at that time I was at the Institute für Kulturwissenschaften at Essen and working in a relatively conventional way as an academic. And now I do something totally different, and that has a lot to do with this study and with this book. So to give you some idea of my background, I'm not an environmental scientist. I'm not an environmental psychologist. I just came to this topic of climate change because I come from violence research and theories about mass violence and things like that. I'm a social psychologist and worked many, many years on topics of mass crimes, societal crimes, mass killings and things like that. And as a social psychologist, my question was why people who would never think of themselves as being able to kill or have the willingness to kill somebody else under certain conditions, under certain social circumstances, would decide exactly to do this and would be able to apply some kind of sense to what they do, although it's completely different from their self-concept. And this is a psychological question that's very interesting. It's also a political question that's very interesting. And it's also, in terms of education and all pedagogical aspects, quite interesting, because for a long time in history and also in the educational literature, there was always this question, how can we prevent people from doing evil things? It's a very old question. It was never answered sufficiently. And we saw, especially in the 20th century, many, many examples where people who would be from their self-concept, from their moral convictions, from their religious orientations, without much effort to be brought to the decision to kill other people. Although, if you would have asked these very same persons 2 or 3 months before, if they would ever be able to do something like this or willing to do something like this, they would have answered, no, why should I? This is not my self-concept, and this is not the ideology and not the culture that I come from, to kill other people. So, and we did a lot of studies in this respect. The last one was very interesting because of the material that we could use. This book was also published in English, called Soldaten, and the material is really spectacular because we found that the British Army, as well as the American Army, bugged German prisoners of war's conversations. So they had special camps with microphones and all kinds of things, and they were listening to their everyday conversations about the war, about raping women, about techniques, and whatever were men would talk about. And so we have a material of 150,000 transcribed pages of the perspective of the ordinary German soldier. And this is an unbelievable material because you won't have any comparable thing. It doesn't exist. Yeah, not even from contemporary things, because these things are very well hidden, and they are intended to perform, to sketch yourself as a person so-and-so, because much of this material comes from the trials afterwards and whatever. So here we have conversations where these guys are sitting in their cells and they don't have anything to do, so they talk about what they did. So this gives a lot of material to reconstruct the perspective, to reconstruct what they saw and made them act from their point of view in the way they acted. And I don't want to go too deep into this, but what was really striking in this material was that the picture of the German Wehrmacht soldier as the willing executioner, who is driven by ideology, who is driven by the Nazi concepts of racial inequality and anti-Semitism and so, only applies to a minority of these soldiers. It applies very much to the SS. We have also SS soldiers in the material. There the ideological aspect is much stronger, as in the Wehrmacht. But these people do all the atrocities that they frankly report amongst each others without any ideological conviction, which makes it even more frightening and puzzling, because they report very in a very epic way, rapings of women, killing of enemies and whatever. They report all kinds of crimes they committed, and they report also surprisingly much about what we later called the Holocaust, which means the extermination by direct killings and later by the mode of the extermination camps. This is interesting because there was always a big discussion, especially in Germany, but also in the international debate amongst historians, how much the Germans knew about it and how much the Wehrmacht soldiers knew. And we could relatively, with this material, could show that everybody knew everything. We found something that might sound extremely contradictory, because these guys did all kinds of cruel things without having much problems with it. Most of them reported proudly. We have examples where they invent cruel things that didn't happen in reality. This says something about how they can gain status and so, what kind of communicative mode they were in. But they have also, they distance themselves from certain types of killing and violence. And this is quite interesting, because they report on the one hand that they dislike how the German Wehrmacht leaders treated the Russian prisoners of war. This is one of the most brutal chapters in the history of the Second World War because the German Wehrmacht let these people, these Russian prisoners, starve, treated them extremely bad. Millions of them died. Was totally against the conventions and so. And these happenings, these phenomena, are highly criticized in the conversations of the soldiers. And they say, you cannot treat people like this. They don't like it. They don't accept it. They find it really awful. Why? Because these other guys are soldiers. They do the same job as they do, and they sit in the British and American camps, are treated totally different, and they cannot accept it because they put it in a military frame of reference. So this is not correct. On other occasions, they tell stories about that they made prisoners, Russian soldiers, Red Armies, and shot them right away. And this is totally okay. It's absolutely okay. No problem with that. Because there are situational factors that they would have trouble to bring them back, yeah, to their camp or whatever, and maybe getting into trouble by themselves, so they kill them. Quite normal. No discussion about this. Yeah? Same seemingly contradiction between reports about killing of Jews, and they don't like it. Either they don't like it, the things that have been reported to them, or a few have been involved, and nobody likes it. Nobody is affirming this, that there are women and kids are killed just because the SS ordered it and whatever. And they don't like it at all. But this is not because they have another political idea about it or some moral judgment. This is because they don't understand what this has to do with military action. They have no idea. On the other hand, when they think they fight against partisans and burn down villages and kill women and children, it's completely okay because there's a reference frame that this is fighting partisans. A partisan can be everybody. We have also these episodes from the Vietnam Creek and from My Lai and whatever. So the interesting thing is that the most important mode of sense-making and position actions that one has done by himself is to put in different reference frames. That means as soon as you have something where you have a kind of frame for sense-making, for ordering in something that is understood as my ordinary task, as something that has to be done because I'm here to have to do something like this, it's okay. And they have no moral judgment about it. As soon as it is something that seems to be unprofessional to them or not justified by any concept or so, they find it completely bad to do this. And this gives a hint to the role of background factors like ideology, political convictions, and all these things. And after we did this study, we had the interpretation that these ideological questions are totally overvalued in historical interpretations. It is not, because we can also show that we have in this material totally convinced Nazis, a huge group of apolitical soldiers who don't have the slightest interest in politics and whatever. So they have no idea about these things, apolitical. And then we have a group of decidedly anti-Nazi guys, ex-communists and whatever, because all these people were in the German army. And they have political debates in this conversation, but as soon as it comes to concrete military action, to concrete performance of violence, they don't differ at all. They don't differ at all. They do all the same. They can fight against each other in an argumentative way when it comes to this abstract concepts. Is Hitler a good guy or not? Nazis, whatever. So, but in a professional sense, doing their jobs, they do all the same. So for the better and the worse, in both directions, ideological, political, and whatever, ethical convictions don't do anything or almost nothing when it comes to fulfill a perceived task. What is required from me, what people want from me, is the certain point. And as people act in groups in this situation, it is even more so because the reference group of persons is the actual group that they are in, and not the teacher back in Germany, not somebody who is giving political speeches, not the mother, whatever. So these factors are quite interesting. So to sum this up, this work on these mass violence things made it much more, to me, much more appropriate to think about violence in situational frames, not so much in ideological or personality psychology respects. Yeah, there's a huge tradition to trace this tendency to act violently back to biographies and personal structures and things like that. It's much more the concrete situation. And therefore, the work that we did in this respect is not so much historical, is not adding data to historical knowledge, but it's much more about potential. What can be executed under given conditions? What can be done with people? And the interesting thing is that you can almost do everything, and people are always, almost any time, able to apply sense to it. This is an interesting mode, yeah, that they want to do their job really good, and this requires some kind of personal subjective addition to it. I want to do this better than my comrade and whatever. So this mode of sense-making makes the people identified even with something where they would never have thought that they could do it. Then I was interested, but not scientifically, but just on an everyday level, in all these issues of climate change and all the reports and papers and the scenarios that were developed of what climate researchers developed as future perspectives. And at a certain point, I thought, well, okay, if these guys are right, what does it mean for the potential for violence in the future? Because if they are right, then it simply means that the living conditions and the survival conditions in different parts of the world will go under stress, even more stress in already stressed areas. And what will people do then? What does it mean? And then I was trying to search the literature and try to find something about this specific aspect, the interrelationship between climate change and violent conflict. And to my surprise, there was almost nothing about it. And to my even greater surprise, I realized at this point, this is like 10, 12 years ago, that the whole field of climate impact research was to 95 or 99% dominated by scientists and not by people from the humanities, or not by historians, not by sociologists, and so. Yeah? And I thought, wow, this is amazing, because what this data reveals is a prognosis about changing circumstances of survival. Because what cultures and groups always do, nowadays on a sophisticated level, but basically is to find practices of survival. And if this is changing so severely, why wouldn't there be any type of research about it? So then I tried to make this sketch in where this book, Climate Wars, is the product. The title is spectacular, especially the subtitle, and it's not only spectacular, but also speculative. Because this book is not something where you would find sentences like we will see a war between Afghanistan and whatever in the year 2035 because of the desertification in this and that area. Not in this concrete way. What this book tries to do is to investigate potentials for future conflicts. And it has three different perspectives. One is a historical one, the other one is collecting data for contemporary phenomena, and one is future outlooks. And the potentials that I see or saw at that point are very simple. And I just can mention them briefly here because it's really simple. It's totally evident that in the case where you have restricted living conditions, like in sub-Saharan Africa or whatever, you will face immediately very dangerous problems when you have phenomena like land degradation, like desertification and whatever. And then you have these situations where people, different groups, start to compete about the same piece of land. So, but this is something severe because we have many failed states, we have many interested parties in escalating conflicts and whatever. So this is one field where we see more potential. And in this book, there's a list of low-level conflicts that have a relationship to environmental changes, that again have a relationship to climate change, and you will see a surprising number of conflicts that have this relationship, much more than we would normally see when we see the news or read about the statistics of wars and whatever. So this is one aspect that has a direct relationship, scarcity of resources because of the impact of climate change. The other thing is related to this, and this is migration, because many people do not migrate because of the direct impact of climate change, but the indirect, that there is a conflict and they have to go. They themselves perceive what they have to do not in this context. They perceive the others as aggressors or whatever, and they see that they have to leave the country. And then you have two big scenarios for conflicts. The one is the Binnenmigration, the migration in the country, which is very, very difficult, as we all know, because especially in poor countries, there's always organizational deficits and competition between the people who are there and whatever, and the other aspects to migrate across the borders and to try to find some land, society where you can make a living or survive. And then we have this indirect consequences of climate change also on the European level, because this constant perceived problem of too much migration from Africa to Europe is, of course, puzzling all the European administrations and so on. There's huge interest and huge investments in border control and whatever. And the only effect that this has is that normally the refugees would take routes with higher risk, and we have more people who die in the Mediterranean seas and whatever. But this is also a potential for more violent, for more violence in the future, and also moving in the dialectics between security, perceived need for security, and the willingness to let people not participate in your beautiful life and better conditions. So there's also an escalative dynamics in it. Another aspect is what happens when, because of the melting ice, routes become free where you can do transportation and so, and have shortcuts compared to the time 20 years ago, whatever, and the whole field of resources, raw materials that can be accessed because the ice is going away. and the very difficult problem that the international regulations in this field are not very elaborated, and it's always, if there are raw materials, interesting resources, there's always a potential for conflict. So, and then one can say that in the end, we will see a deepening of the potentiality of the societies who are on the winner side of the whole process, at least for the next decades, and the ones who are on the loser side. German sociologist Lars Clausen called this the failed globalization, because what he saw in his analysis was that, of course, if the stress is getting higher and the problems for many societies become more severe and deeper, the organizational power of the others who don't have these problems but are richer and better organized and whatever grow relatively bigger. So the balances of power change by this process. And we will see, that was his perspective, we will see with the ongoing process a division, a very much deeper division of winners and losers. And I think this is not unrealistic. And I think it is also to be observed even now in the present, and it's not a future thing. So, and this makes the whole perspective a little bit depressing. But because there are not many indicators that things will change into a better direction. To go a bit deeper into this and to sharpen this observation, one can also say we have in societies like the German, the Swiss, the French, here in America, of course, during this last 40 years, a heightened consciousness concerning these environmental, ecological, and climate issues. If we look at the questionnaires, at the things where people are asked what they are concerned about, and all these things, we see that people are really here, as I know, in the States not so much, but in Germany people are really concerned about climate change, for example. And we don't have the scene of climate skeptics, and so therefore it's a very broad cognitive and emotional involvement in these things. And if you look at the ads for new cars, for example, you will always find ads that would say that the new Porsche Cayenne is very good for the environment and is also very good for the climate. In the end, it was constructed to do something for the climate. If you look at the statements, the leading statements of the companies, you will always find the words sustainability and climate protection and so on. So we have on the, and if you look at the schools and the kindergarten and so, all these topics are very much on the agenda, so that we can say during the last 40 years, we had a very, very successful movement in changing mindsets. Absolutely great. Green Party, all these things. And a little bit puzzling is a look to the numbers. When you look at the growth rates in CO2 emissions, in the rates of extracted materials, in the rates of produced waste and all these things, then you will see some parallel lines. One is the increased consciousness, and the other one is the increased use of material, energy, and the production of waste and emission. And I think this is really really something, and now I speak again as a social psychologist, this is really a puzzling thing, how these two developments coexist without producing schizophrenia or deep dissonances and whatever. So, but then the question is there an interrelationship between knowledge and action? This is what everybody thinks, that there's an interrelationship, and all educational efforts in this field. We have this decade of Bildung für nachhaltige Entwicklung, education for sustainable development. Much is invested in this, but the underlying idea is as soon as people know something, they would act accordingly. But what we see is the exact opposite of it. They know really a lot, but they do everything totally different. It's quite interesting. And if you look at the numbers, and I did this after these debates and after reflecting about these things, that we have in Germany as well as in the US and in the rich countries, we have a doubling of all product segments every 10 years. This is really something surprising, yeah, in the context of these discussions. We have every 10 years the double consumer amount, the double amount of products in textiles, for example. We have the doubling in 10 years in furniture, and not to talk about all these electronic things and whatever. And what we see is a constant increase in the material used for producing these products, and a shortening in the cycles of these products, because yeah, they're very, very short. The new car comes very much faster, the new phone and whatever. And people think that they are highly conscious about environmental issues. They look at the labels. They want to buy the most efficient product, but they don't realize that they buy much, much more of these highly efficient products than ever before. And the growth rates in these fields are really amazing. And if you take in respect that this is now a worldwide thing, and the globalization means that this principle is spreading all over the world, we have a very severe problem. And this problem is not addressed by telling people something about environmental problems, yeah? Because this is not mixed. To be cynical, one could say what capitalism managed to do, and this is, capitalism is really a brilliant principle because it can incorporate everything. What it managed to do after the limits to growth and the first stage and phase of a deep discussion is to establish a new field, because capitalism is about division of labor. So here we have this problem. Oh God, all these environmental problems, whatever. We need people who professionalize in dealing with these environmental problems. We need people who write books about it. We need institutions that are established to be concerned. We need international conferences, whatever. And this is a new field. This is, let's say, the industry of the concerned. And we have this other field. This is the industry of the non-concerned who do their business as usual. And they don't disturb each other that much. It works. Capitalism works this way. And from a psychological point of view, what is quite interesting is that we don't realize, as members of a given society, the changing process of these societies, because we move within the changing circumstances, the shifting baselines phenomenon, that you don't have an indicator what has changed. So that people, for example, in Germany, don't have the slightest idea that their living conditions differ extremely from the conditions only 20 years ago, They wouldn't realize it. They complained that everything is so expensive, that gas is so expensive, that goods are so expensive, that milk is so expensive. And if you look at the statistics, you will see that everything is extremely cheap compared to the time 20 years ago, and even much cheaper compared to 40 years ago. What people had to invest in work to buy a television set or jeans or whatever, or a bread, was much, much more than it is today. Yeah? But they think, everybody thinks, okay, things are getting more expensive all the time, and they think it was always the case that you could go into some electric store and could find 200 different machines to produce coffee, and that your only problem is to find the best one out of it. So, and therefore, what we draw as a conclusion out of these suggestions of these ideas and so is that we thought, okay, we know enough. No more research is needed, which is a really surprising thing, as you all know, because you will never find a paper with the sentence, no research is needed anymore, because it's always that we need more research. But in this respect, not. We need something, and this is then not a scientific issue anymore. We need something to break this up, this division of labor, this thing of peaceful coexistence of being concerned and doing the wrong things. So we had an idea to turn the whole communication about these topics totally around and stop talking about the dangers, stop talking about the apocalyptic aspects and whatever. So this book is some way very distant from me now. I mean, it's interesting, but I'm not so identified with the conclusions. What I find much more interesting is to find fields of action where you can do practically something that helps you to move more in the direction of another type of society, which means, on a general, a more theoretical level, interesting are approaches or projects that go directly into the modes of production and reproduction, or financing things, putting money in something and taking it out of something. So strategies that go directly into the operative mode of the capitalist system, because we are, in writing books, scandalizing things, and so this is something that is totally expected by everybody. This is part of the whole system. Nobody would worry about it. People would start worrying if there are not the critics and if there are no books in this way. But if you start to act within the giving system and try to change the variables there, it's much more interesting what might come out of it. So this is the theoretical idea. And the other theoretical aspect is, and this is really puzzling also still to me because there's no solution for this, is the basic contradiction or the unsolved problem that this type of economy, capitalist growth economy, had so many positive outcomes. First, in material respect. I mean, the life expectancy of people today is double than a little more than 100 years ago. This is unbelievable. The health conditions very much better. The working conditions very much better. Many, many aspects that are extremely positive. And all these material, comfortable things, that car thing and whatever we can equip your life is very much better. This is one aspect, the material progress that is connected to this system. And the other thing is the immaterial aspects that mean that the success of this economic system was closely related to the development of democracy, the development of nation states with free conditions, with the concept of free persons, autonomous persons, citizenship, and all these other things like legal state and social security, educational system, things like that. So, and this is highly attractive. There was never, I think, never a system before in history that in such a short amount of time made such a visible progress in bettering the concrete living conditions of people and also developed a civilizatory standard that is, in historical comparison, completely outstanding. Democracy. It's a good thing. Yeah. And now we have the problem that because of the impact of climate change and all the other environmental problems, societies of our time get so much under stress that we will lose this civilizatory standard. You know, all the discussions about democracy and threatening of democracies and whatever. So there's, again, a shifting of perspective. But the question that I have is, and this is the task we should discuss, is how to maintain the civilizatory standard that we that comes from this capitalist system. How can we maintain the civilizatory standard with a use of material and energy that is lowered to 20% compared to now? Nobody knows how this would work. And this is not gained and achieved by higher efficiency. Yeah? So, and it is will not be possible in keeping this material standard. It has to be less because I don't have to explain this in this before this audience. So the civilizatory task and therefore the political task is what can we do to keep this standard and change everything else? And this is something where if you would find somebody who would know a solution for this, I mean, this would be really a sensation. Nobody knows how this can be achieved because we have a lot of ideas, we have techniques and things like that. Everybody is totally concentrated on the CO2 and the energy problematic. But all these other aspects of our cultural practices, of our consumer practices and whatever, is not touched by this at all. So how to develop a modern society that turns from an expansive type of society to a reductive type of society? This is really something. So, and as we have no idea how this works, how this will work, and as there is no master plan for things like that, we had the idea that we can do something not only different in the communicative, on the communicative level, but also on the practical. So the idea is very simple, and many people do this already, that we search individuals, projects, groups, companies that under the given conditions of a modern society like the German society do things differently. That means a company who refuses to grow and say, no, we don't want to take part in this type of competition anymore. Companies who would do all the things that are necessary for their production differently than an ordinary company would do. Cooperatives that would find themselves to produce energy on a local level, big thing in Germany. Groups that would take care for a community garden, all these things, repair cafes, million things that are going on, also in the context of transition towns movement and whatever, and to tell stories about it. Not scientific investigations, but simply telling stories about it. So what our foundation does is approaching these people, writing stories about them after visiting them, and communicate these stories in on our homepage, but also in the traditional form of books and also in established media like newspapers and television programs, without any kind of moral framework. Because there's never a headline, what you will read now is to save the world. Yeah, it is only because we have a problem. We communicate these stories as stories in itself, because they are good stories. If somebody is running a shoe factory in a completely weird way, and in the end there are very good shoes, and everybody is totally happy from the ones who work in this factory, and they get all the material from the region, and they give the workers food from local farmers, bio and organic and whatever, this is interesting in itself. This is interesting in itself. And how this can be managed and achieved is very interesting. So you need the classical form of a story where you have interesting persons, where you can tell something about them, where you can also tell something about difficulties, because a good story is never a story that has only one dimension. And these stories appear to find a lot of interest because it's a completely different way of communicating these topics than we are used to. Newspapers never tell good stories, so we tell good stories. And we tell these good stories not in environmental magazines or in the German Tageszeitung, yeah, where the already converted read it, and so, but we tell them in the most conservative newspapers without any reference frames. So we have a series, for example, in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the most established and the most conservative paper in Germany, and there is a format that is called True Stories from wahre Geschichten, True Stories of a Visible Future. And then there's a story about this shoe guy, yeah, who's producing the shoes and other things. And it's quite surprising because people find it really interesting. And they find it especially interesting because it is not framed as something eco or green or sustainable or climate change or apocalypse now or whatever. Yeah, but interesting in itself. And we did series in public television programs where our cases were transformed into little movies and things like that. So the strategy is to bring positive stories as a kind of, you know, message in a bottle in the into the normal society, to bring an idea which is politically important, to show that the business as usual is not without alternatives, and that there are so many different things that each member of the society could identify with this or that, because there are many different positions in a society, and not everybody can run a company or whatever, but there are also single persons or students' initiatives and whatever. So, and the idea was to establish this kind of promotion agency for a social movement that doesn't know that it's already existing. This was the basic idea when we set up this foundation. And yeah, this was the long story of the consequences of the book about killing, yeah, in the context of climate change. And maybe it is worthwhile to discuss what the outcomes of this might be, because I think, and I end up with this reflection, that it was of course extremely important what Dennis Meadows and the colleagues did with the Limits to Growth. And it was extremely important what a lot of scientists and academics did after that. And it was also extremely important to have something like a green movement and green parties and so. But all these social developments establish forms of communication and formatting their political agendas that go out of fashion after they have been successful. So if there's somebody in a society like this one here, or the German society, who is under 40 years old. He has never heard anything different concerning the status of the world, different from that is completely devastated and it will be destroyed and whatever. So this is the normal expectation. Nobody is surprised. Oh, there's climate change. Oh, there is depletion of the ocean, whatever. Everybody reads the article with the expectation, bad news. Yeah. So this type of communication doesn't fulfill the function that it perfectly fulfilled in the beginning. Yeah, because it's normal communication. It's played in into the whole surface of communication. Therefore, there has to be something made differently. And the other aspect is that psychologically spoken, it is much more, much better to motivate people if you try to tell good stories than having the wrong idea to motivate people to action by telling always catastrophic stories. This is psychologically not very fruitful. Yeah, and the other thing is that with this sample of stories, we learn a lot about which way, which direction can be followed if we really want to go to this type of reductive society, because in this project they serve as real-life experiments and labors, laboratories, to try to find other ways of using material and energy and doing something with it. And they find also other ways of dealing with each other, that means cultural and social practices. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Harold Veltzer, professor for transformation design at the University of Flensburg. Professor Veltzer's lecture was titled Climate Wars: What People Will Be Killed For in the 21st Century, and was presented by the Center for the Study of Europe at Boston University and co-sponsored by the Goethe Institute Boston, the Goethe Institute Washington, D.C., and Brandeis University Center for German and European Studies. Tonight's moderator was Henrik Selin, Associate Professor of International Relations at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Chris Johnson. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.